I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. This year's Ebola outbreak has been the largest in history. The disease has hit hard in West Africa, with outbreaks in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. And isolated cases in the United States have garnered intense media coverage and sparked a political firestorm with differing opinions on how to deal with Ebola from Congress, the White House, and at the state level. Dr. Terry Howard is a staff counsellor with UNICEF. Terry Howard is from Orlando. He's a graduate of the University of Central Florida. He spent time in Nigeria, which also had Ebola cases, but in October was declared Ebola-free. He counselled Ebola patients, their families and neighbours. He joins the program to talk about his experience and the United States' response to the Ebola outbreak. A conversation about Ebola, that's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Terry Howard. Dr. Howard is a staff counsellor at UNICEF. He's been working with UNICEF in Nigeria for the past year. Dr. Howard, thank you very much for joining me.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, you were, first of all, in Nigeria for a year. They had an outbreak of Ebola, but a pretty small one compared to some of the other cases that we've seen in Liberia and other West African nations.
Yeah, that's correct. They had, over the course of the months that the crisis was ongoing, they had 20 cases and 8 deaths associated with those 20 cases.
Here in the United States, where there's been a couple cases, one death, there has been a lot of fear associated with this disease. How did the population in Nigeria respond to those cases?
Well, when the first case broke out, and I don't know if your listeners are aware of how the crisis started in Nigeria, but a Liberian man had flown into Nigeria. He was symptomatic when he left Liberia, landed at the Lagos airport, and collapsed at the airport. He was taken to the hospital immediately. And as doctors and nurses do, they treated him, not knowing for sure what it was that he had. And he died a few days later. And then those same doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers that were tending to him started to come down with the various symptoms. Mm-hmm. And over the course of time, the fear that broke out was rather dramatic. Everybody was afraid. Everybody was scared that it was going to spread like wildfire. And fortunately for the country, that never happened. They were able to contain it fairly quickly. The government initiated a rapid response team. They brought in people from the CDC, WHO, and Doctors Without Borders. And then a large contingent of staff members from UNICEF came in to help in a variety of ways. And that's how I got brought into the situation.
So you went to Nigeria knowing that that was going to be your job, or was it something that kind of came across your desk once you got there?
I went to Nigeria as a staff counselor. That was my job. I'd been doing that already for 8 or 10 months before the outbreak was established. And so in my role as a staff counselor, I was providing counseling services to the UNICEF staff members. All of a sudden now we have this crisis. And to its credit, the Nigerian government wanted to provide counseling support, or what they refer to as psychosocial support, to the people that had Ebola, the actual patients, as well as their family members and any other members of the community that may need it. And that's a unique approach. Most situations are looking at the focus on the physical health and the physical aspects of Ebola and what it does. But I give Nigeria credit that they were also looking at the mental health aspects and the psychological impact that such a disease can have on everybody, basically.
So as a staff counselor for UNICEF, what's the run-of-the-mill kind of job that you're doing, aside from having to deal with the effects of a crisis like Ebola?
I meet with staff members and whatever their issues of the day happen to be. So just the same way that you would have issues in any office, you know, somebody's supervisor is treating them badly. They didn't get the promotion they wanted. They've got financial issues. They've got issues with their family members, educationally oriented issues, career advancement sort of issues, sort of just mundane, day-to-day, run-of-the-mill things that people are worried about. Mm-hmm. And I help them process those a little bit in a counseling capacity. And then the Ebola situation, very, very different, because now I'm working with the Nigerian population that's being impacted directly by the disease. Mm-hmm. So it was just a very different take. And I didn't know really what I was getting into when it got started. So it was kind of learning as I went.
This Ebola outbreak has been called the worst in history by the CDC. You explained how the Nigerian case began and how that sort of spread. It sounds like Nigeria has, and you credit them for putting in some psychological help as well as, you know, the medical help. Mm. From your experience, from what you've seen, are they pretty well set up to deal with it from a medical point of view?
Well, the medical conditions and medical situations and facilities and resources are somewhat limited, definitely limited compared to what we would have here in the United States. But compared to many other African nations, Nigeria is pretty well off. It was just proclaimed to be it has the highest economy on the entire continent of Africa. It outpassed South Africa just mm-hmm. recently, and that's a source of pride for the nation. So they do have facilities, but the reality was they weren't set up for this. They didn't know how to deal with it. They didn't have the processes and procedures in place in terms of the immediacy of the need. Fortunately for the country, they've had ongoing campaigns related to polio vaccinations for many, many years. It's one of the few countries around the world that still has issues with polio. Mm-hmm. And because they've been traveling and having these teams of people going from house to house to vaccinate people for polio, they were able to draw upon the way that particular system ran to do the contact tracing when Ebola broke out. So that they used a lot of the processes. And also, to its credit, the government brought in these professionals to help work with the Nigerian nationals to mentor them and sort of guide them and direct them and help them build the skills so that when all the internationals pulled out, they had a trained set of people in place ready to take over. And that worked fairly well.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Dr. Terry Howard. He's a staff counselor at UNICEF. He's just back from Nigeria, where he's been working with UNICEF, helping counsel some of the staff involved in an outbreak, which is Nigeria is now declared free of Ebola. You can join the program on Intersection and on Facebook and Twitter at WMFE Orlando. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. When you talk about polio and the campaign to eradicate that disease, what's your understanding of how successful that campaign has been? Because when we hear stories about Ebola and the efforts to try and get the word out, get information out about the danger of this disease, sometimes that information isn't very well received. So do you think that the Nigerian government, in the case of polio, has done a good job of sort of spreading the word and making sure people understand what's going on there?
They're trying desperately to get people to understand the need for vaccinating everyone for polio. Mm-hmm. The difficulty is in the very, very rural areas, you've got densely populated groups, and they don't have much access to media coverage. So it's hard to get the information out there. Radio, they try using that as a medium. Most of the people in these rural areas don't have television, so that's typically not an option for them. They actually have what's called social mobilization campaigns, where people go out and literally go from house to house to house, knocking on doors and explaining to them the importance of vaccinating and having everybody vaccinated for polio. And it's slow going. I mean, they have a population of 170 million people, very rural, very difficult in terms of transport to get to some of these places and resources, you know, in terms of keeping the vaccines in the proper conditions and so on. There's just all these hurdles that you have to jump over to make it successful. So they're making great inroads, but there's still a lot to do.
Mm-hmm. And translating some of those issues to getting the word out about Ebola, what have mm-hmm. you seen in the way that Nigerian government has gone about trying to spread the word about, you know, the dangers mm-hmm. of Ebola and how not to spread it?
Well, part of the emergency response team that I was operating with, they were doing a whole variety of different things to develop posters and campaigns and notices and jingles on the television or radio to help educate the people. They were setting up and doing some training to get people to go into the different schools so that they could train the teachers, who could then sort of trickle it down to the student bodies. And it worked fairly well. And over the course of the couple of months, the message evolved a little bit from initially it was just, it tended to be all very negative in that, you know, pretty much if you've got to be careful, if you get Ebola, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And the message gradually changed to, you need to seek treatment early, you need to get treatment early, and you need to be aware of the symptoms, go to the hospital, get yourself tested. If you know that you've had direct contact with somebody, the sooner that you begin the treatment, the more likely it is that you will live. So the message changed a little bit from you get it and you're going to die to treat it early and your chances of living are greatly increased. So just changing the message helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard stories of how they've, in some places, they've enlisted the help of people who've had Ebola, survived, mm-hmm. to become spokespeople and say, look, you can survive this disease. Have they done that in Nigeria?
They did that a little bit later on. The commissioner for health, I believe he had a press conference where some of the survivors were brought in, and he was shown publicly greeting them to try to reduce some of the stigma that people were experiencing that were associated with Ebola. But in general, Nigeria didn't have a whole lot of coverage of its immediate situation in terms of going into the treatment centers, you know, news coverage of these different facilities. It was very, very limited, and Nigeria very specifically tended to limit the amount of coverage that it had on its own situation, other than reporting the numbers and the successes and the things that they were doing. But in terms of media coverage, compared to many of the other places, it was limited.
Mm-hmm. What was your experience of how folks at UNICEF responded, and what kind of challenges did you have going about counseling them when this disease broke and stories started coming in from other countries about how bad it was there?
Okay. Well, my job in terms of the Ebola outbreak was I was flown from Abuja, where I live, to the city of Lagos. Huge, huge city, 21 million people in Lagos. More people in Lagos than in all of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea combined. So a massive population. And in this instance, now I wasn't working with UNICEF staff. I was going to the treatment center and working with the Ebola patients. I was going to the homes of the Ebola patients and working with their family members or people in their local communities. That's a twist on my job, because usually I'm just dealing with the UNICEF personnel, and here now I'm working with the Nigerian population that's immediately affected by the disease. So for me, that was a change. I was working with an entirely different set of people and loved it. It was great and very, very much appreciated. It opened my eyes to a lot of different things related to the disease that were very different than what the media was portraying. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a big eye-opener to just see how different the reality was than what the media was saying about it. So I learned a lot about it. I learned from the CDC personnel and the WHO and the Doctors Without Borders. I was going to the treatment centers, interacting with them, learning from them, doing some in-service training for the Nigerian staff members who were working in the treatment centers, and so on. So my job took a big shift, mm-hmm. In terms of who I was actually providing service for.
When you say it was different from how the media was portraying it, what do you mean by that?
Well, at that point in time, it was pretty much all gloom and doom. And the image that was being projected by the media, as I was seeing it, my access to media where I live is very limited. I don't have a television. I don't have a radio. So I would just see whatever was online and whatever reports that UNICEF itself was putting out. But in general, the message was, you get Ebola, you're going to die. It's extremely dangerous. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. That was sort of the general take. And in terms of the symptomology of people who have Ebola, I was envisioning people bleeding from every orifice and, you know, looking like they're going to fall over and die any second. And so as I was exposed to people in the hospital, especially the first time that I went and saw the actual confirmed cases, I didn't know who they were. They looked just like you and me. They were sitting outside on the veranda of the confirmed ward. They had barriers up between with a couple of meters of space from I could stand in front of this four-foot-high barrier. Like 3 or 4 meters away was another barrier, and they were sitting over there on the veranda chatting with each other and drinking their water, and they looked pretty normal compared to what the media was portraying. And so part of part of what Nigeria did well is, and they had, they were lucky, if you, you know, that's not a good word to use, but they were fortunate in that the people in Nigeria who came down with the disease initially were medical personnel. So they understood the disease, they understood the symptoms, they understood the importance of what to do and not to do in terms of to save themselves as well as to protect their family members and their community members.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you say when you went to visit these people, there was a barrier between you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to wear the protective equipment that we've seen, you know, images of the medical staff wearing?
Very, very good question. And my expectation the first time that I went to the treatment center was that I would be covered from head to toe. And the reality was I've never worn it, not even once. And because the disease is not airborne and I wasn't going into the wards to mm-hmm. meet with people directly, there was no need for me to wear that. And I was apprehensive at first, to be quite honest. When I went in, I expected to have to wear all of this and never did put it on. I never did go into the actual wards with the people. I could have if there was a need. There was just never that need. So I would talk to them and counsel them from a distance. So
how does that work? I mean, that must be for a counsel. I mean, usually
it's not optimum.
You're pretty close to the person you're talking to,
exactly.
Right? So that must have been tricky.
It was a unique situation for me as a counselor because, as you said, I'm used to sort of typically working with somebody one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a private, somewhat isolated situation, at least where there's a level of privacy, and here I would literally be standing against a barrier that only went up about 4 meters. So, you know, from chest high up, I'm not covered. From chest high up, they're not covered. And we would talk across this barrier. And the barrier could be, or the distance between the barriers, rather, would be anywhere from like a meter and a half to maybe 3 or 4 meters. So I'm talking to them from that distance.
Mm-hmm.
The level of privacy was minimal because anybody else sitting around outside could possibly hear us. So we would move as far away as we could. But that was the best situation that we had. And for the most part, it worked okay. Most people were very respectful of the other. So if I was talking with somebody, they would move off to the side or, you know, they would distract themselves and talk amongst themselves while I talked to a particular individual. Sometimes I just went and talked as a group. They were all sitting there together and just sort of helped them process. On occasion, they had family members or friends that were visiting them at the hospital. Again, they didn't have to wear any of the protective gear because they were sitting and talking from a distance. But sometimes I would counsel them, the family members there, and as a group with the patient involved in the situation. But never did have to wear the PPE.
Mm-hmm.
Never wore it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to Dr. Terry Howard. He's been working in Nigeria doing counselling in that country while they've been undergoing cases of Ebola. You can join the conversation online. You can send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, and you can find us on Facebook too. Dr. Howard, I'm curious to know, too, what your experience of, you know, dealing with or talking to folks who've experienced the disease, their loved ones are undergoing this terrible disease. Was that a challenge for you and a special challenge you know, compared to your usual line of work?
Very different than my usual line of work. When you compare Ebola with talking to somebody about, you know, that their supervisor was mean to them or they didn't get a promotion, and when you compare that to Ebola where the patients were extremely concerned, the assumption was that they were going to die. So on their part. So their mindset was focused on, when am I going to die? How bad is this going to get? What's going to happen to me next before I die? They were very concerned about those kind of things. And then you combine that with the guilt that they were feeling of, did I give this to my children? Did I give it to my spouse? Did I give it to everybody when I went to church last weekend? Lots of fear associated with it, as you can imagine. That was very difficult. And for me, it was tough, just from a perspective of, here I am talking to this person, I'm getting to know this person, I know they have Ebola, are they going to be dead in a couple of days? You know, are they going to continue to decline and ultimately die? That was tough to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, very different from my normal day-to-day counseling responsibilities with the UNICEF staff members.
If I could just switch gears a wee bit and talk about how the disease has been reported on and the response to some of the cases here in the United States. For a start, we have this 21-day quarantine for returning nurse Casey Hickox. That ends this week, and that story made headlines after she challenged the state of New Jersey's mandatory quarantine, which is outside of what the CDC recommends, I believe. What are your thoughts on how some of the states have gone about trying to protect the citizens of their states and make sure that the disease doesn't spread here in the United States?
Well, I can appreciate the fact that the politicians and other personnel want to protect people. That's understandable. However, if you understand the disease itself and the way that it progresses, there's no reason to be concerned about somebody if they're not symptomatic. So, I mean, I don't know this particular woman that you're talking about. I've seen a couple of articles and news reports here in the U.S., but I don't know her personally. But the fact is that she didn't need to be quarantined. If she's not symptomatic, then there's no possibility that she can give the disease to anyone else. So I would question, why are you quarantining somebody who isn't sick? Mm-hmm. And that makes it difficult. If you're quarantining somebody after they come back, then what will the next person think in terms of possibly going there to provide service? What are they then going to face when they get back? Is this going to deter somebody from wanting to go to assist where the need is so great if they're going to have to be quarantined when they return, when there's no real need for the quarantine? Again, I can understand the fear, and you need to be respectful of people's fear. But the reality is somebody who is not symptomatic in terms of the Ebola symptoms, they're not infectious. So there's no reason to be afraid. There's no need to quarantine them. And I want to believe that somebody like her, who out of the goodness of her heart of wanting to help people, went for that particular reason, to try to help people. So I want to believe that she's not of the mindset that she's going to come back here and then give all, you know, throw away all caution and possibly infect everybody. She knows about the disease. She was there treating it firsthand. So if she showed any signs or symptoms, I want to believe that she would have gone and sought treatment as early as she possibly could if any sort of symptom showed up for her. It just seems that that would be the morally responsible thing to do. And again, not knowing her, I would assume that that's what she would have done. So no need to be afraid of her. No need to be cautious around her. Let her do what she needs to do. And if she shows symptoms, then give her the treatment that she needs.
Do you think countries in the West, the United States, other Western nations are doing enough to help fight Ebola?
The need is tremendous, from what I understand, in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. And they just, we're so used to here in the States having easy access to medical facilities. It's just something that we take for granted. We've got hundreds of places to choose from that are fairly close to us. And you know you're going to get good quality care in a very, very pleasant facility for the most part. That would apply for most of us. And in some of these countries, the facilities are so few and far between. And then having trained personnel who really know and understand and have the proper credentials and the proper training to provide the treatment that's needed, it's really lacking. So are we doing enough? A lot of people are still needed, a lot of people in a lot of different capacities. And I like to think that those who want to go and help would have the opportunity to do that and be supported in their attempt to go and do that in whatever way they could, not only while they're there, but then once they come home to get the treatment, the respect and dignity that they deserve when they come back home.
Mm-hmm. Are you going back to Nigeria?
I leave this coming weekend for Abuja again. And then just prior to me coming to the U.S., I was, it had been 4 weeks since I was last associated with Ebola before I came to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the week that I was getting ready to travel here, I was asked to travel to Liberia to work with UNICEF personnel in Liberia. I'm very, very anxious to do that. I'd be very happy to do that. However, I was reluctant to go for a short time to Liberia and then turn around and then come for my leave as I did, because I knew I would probably get stopped back here. So I wanted to come here, finish up my leave, and then turn around and go back. My hope is that request for me to go to Liberia will still be there when I return. And I'll leave as soon as I can. If they want me to go there, I'll go.
Are you worried? Are you fearful for your safety if you go to Liberia where the outbreak is so much bigger than it was in Nigeria?
No, I'm not at all fearful of that. Actually, I lived in Liberia many, many years back in the early 80s. I lived there. I was there as a Peace Corps volunteer. And for me, it would, because I understand the culture, I know how the people think, and I know the hospitality that the people have there. I would be very willing to go to Liberia in a second. I wouldn't even give a thought to it. And in terms of my own personal safety, I know what precautions one needs to take, and I would employ those precautions and keep myself safe while I'm able to do whatever is needed.
Now, you talked about the hospital situation in Nigeria. What's your understanding of what you would be dealing with in Liberia? Is it at a level below that of Nigeria?
I think it would be at a level much below what was in Nigeria. In Nigeria, they took a former tuberculosis unit and converted it rather rapidly into two separate wards, of a suspect ward and a confirmed ward, to process the Ebola patients through. So they had the resources. The structure was already there. Nigeria was very fortunate because the numbers were so small, they could handle it. In Liberia, they're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of people in each facility. So it would be a very different scenario that I'd be facing there.
Mm-hmm.
And the need is just much greater. And the facilities, though, based on when I was there many, many, many years ago, the facilities were very limited then, and I can't imagine after the Civil War and all these other difficulties that the country has had while it's trying to pull itself back up, I can't imagine that the facilities are much better at this point.
And from your point of view, I wonder if you'll have the same situation where you're talking to people from behind a barrier, or whether you'll be expected to don the PPEs, the protective equipment. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been part of the problem, as we've seen in reports mm-hmm. with health workers getting out into some of the more remote communities. They see these people as kind of aliens, and they're reluctant to deal with them.
Right.
So is that going to be an issue if you have to do that?
It makes it, from a counseling perspective, it makes it a little bit more difficult because the person can't see you as readily. And part of the counseling connection is being able to see the person, being able to see the facial expressions and all of that. And when they're looking at you through a mask and this small little eyepiece that you can see through, it makes it more difficult for them to establish a connection or to develop a level of rapport and trust. So I would have to be respectful of what the medical personnel were saying the needs were. But again, because it's not airborne, I wouldn't be so worried as long as there was the proper distance maintained between me and the patients. And I wasn't going in where the individual, all the other stuff, as it were, that they may have had contact with, where I could have contact with that. It was just me talking with somebody to talk behind a barrier or between a barrier would be perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Dr. Terry Howard. He's a staff counselor at UNICEF. We've been speaking about his experience in Nigeria, helping counsel some of the victims and their families of Ebola. He's heading back to Nigeria, possibly Liberia, in just a few days. Dr. Howard, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection, where you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.